individual liberties. Now, with a new variant of the coronavirus rapidly spreading across the globe, face masks are again the focus of conflicting views and fears about the course of pandemic and the restrictions required to manage it. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Ronnie Karen Rabin, Apoorva Mandavili, and Sean Hubler. The piece is titled Mask Again, Delta Variant Spread Prompts Reconsideration of Precautions. Stay with us for more. Throughout the pandemic, face masks have ranked among the most contentious public health measures in the United States, symbolizing a bitter partisan divide over the role of government and individual liberties. Now, with a new variant of the coronavirus rapidly spreading across the globe, face masks are again the focus of conflicting views and fears about the course of pandemic and the restrictions required to manage it. The renewed concerns follow the wildfire growth of the Delta variant of the coronavirus, a highly infectious form of the virus first detected in India and later identified in at least 85 countries. It now accounts for 1 in 5 infections in the United States. In May, federal health officials said that fully vaccinated people no longer needed to mask up, even indoors. The advice signified a sea change in American life, setting the stage for a national reopening that continues to gain momentum. But that was before the spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus. Worried by a global surge in cases, the World Health Organization last week reiterated its long-standing recommendation that everyone, including those who have been inoculated, should wear face masks to stem the spread of the virus. On Monday, 28th of June, health officials in Los Angeles, California, followed suit, recommending that everyone, regardless of vaccination status, should wear face masks indoors in public places as a precautionary measure. Barbara Ferrer, the Los Angeles County's public health director, said the new recommendation was needed because of upticks in infection, a rise in cases due to worrisome Delta variant of the coronavirus, and persistently high numbers of unvaccinated residents, particularly children, Black and Latino residents, and essential workers. Roughly half of Los Angeles County residents are fully vaccinated, and about 60% have had at least one dose of the vaccine. While the number of positive tests is still below 1% in the county, the rate has been inching up, Dr. Ferrer added, and there has been a rise in the number of reinfections among residents who were infected before and did not get vaccinated. To the extent that Los Angeles County has managed to control the pandemic, it has been because of a multi-layered strategy that combined vaccinations with health restrictions aimed at curbing new infections, Dr. Barbara Ferrer said. Natural immunity among those already infected has also kept transmission low, she noted, but it is not clear how long natural immunity will last. We don't want to return to lockdown or more disruptive mandates here, Dr. Barbara Ferrer said, but we want to stay on the path we're on right now, which is keeping community transmission really low. Health officials in Chicago, Illinois, and in New York City said on Tuesday, 29th of June, that they had no plans to revisit face mask requirements. Officials at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, declined to comment, but have not signaled any intention to revise or re-examine masking recommendations for those who are fully vaccinated. When the CDC made the recommendation to quit masking, it didn't anticipate being in a situation where we might need to recommend masking again, said Angela Rasmussen, a research scientist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada. Nobody's going to want to do it. People are understandably accusing them of moving the goalposts. But the Delta variant of the coronavirus's trajectory outside the United States suggests that concerns are likely to intensify. Countries in the Asia-Pacific region are now reimposing restrictions and stay-at-home orders as the Delta variant drives new surges. Four Australian cities have reimposed lockdowns, and on Monday, 28th of June, the Malaysian government said nationwide stay-at-home orders would be extended indefinitely. This is not the first time the world has been consumed by a more contagious variant of the coronavirus. The Alpha variant walloped Britain and brought the rest of Europe to a standstill earlier this year. In the United States, the Alpha variant quickly became the dominant variant by late March, but the rapid pace of vaccination blunted its spread, sparing the nation a big surge in infections. But the Delta variant is thought to be even more fearsome. Much of what is known about the variant is based on its spread in India and in Britain, but early evidence indicates that it's perhaps twice as contagious as the original virus and at least 20% more contagious than the Alpha variant. In many Indian states and European nations, the Delta variant quickly outpaced Alpha to become the dominant version of the coronavirus. It is on track to do the same in the United States. Among the variant's many mutations are some that may help the virus partly dodge the immune system. Several studies have shown that while the current vaccines are effective against Delta variant, they are slightly less so than against most other variants. For individuals who have received only one dose of the two-dose regimen, protection against the variant is significantly reduced compared with efficacy against other forms of the coronavirus. The World Health Organization's rationale for maintaining masking is that while immunization is highly effective at preventing severe illness and death, the degree to which vaccines prevent mild or asymptomatic infections is unknown. Officials at the CDC disagree, saying the risk is minimal. The World Health Organization maintains that vaccinated people should wear face masks in crowded, close, and poorly ventilated areas and should continue with other prevention measures like social distancing. What we're saying is, once you've been fully vaccinated, continue to play it safe, because you could end up as part of a transmission chain. You may not actually be fully protected, Dr. Bruce Aylward, a senior advisor to the World Health Organization, said at a news briefing last week. Even countries with relatively high vaccination rates have seen an increase in infections driven by the Delta variant of the virus. Britain, where some two-thirds of the population have received at least one dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech or AstraZeneca vaccine, and just under half have received two doses of the vaccine, is nonetheless grappling with a sharp rise in infections from the Delta variant. It is not certain what course the Delta variant will take in the United States. Coronavirus infections have been plunging for months, as have hospitalizations and deaths. But Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease doctor, has called the variant the greatest threat to eliminating the virus in the United States. In May, when the Center for Disease Control and Prevention officials lifted masking recommendations, they cited research showing that fully vaccinated people were unlikely to become infected with the virus, even with asymptomatic infections. But the variant's talent for even partial immune evasion makes researchers nervous, as it suggests that fully vaccinated people may sometimes pick up asymptomatic infections and unknowingly spread the virus to others, even if they never become ill themselves. The Delta variant can infect vaccinated people, although its ability to do so is very limited, said Bill Hanaj, an epidemiologist at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. If you are in a place where cases are climbing, wearing a face mask indoors in private public spaces is a way to keep yourself from contributing to the spread of the Delta variant of the virus, he said.
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, this is Mehdi and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about Bangladesh's relations with the Israeli regime. And we shall take a look at the efforts by the United States to establish greater military presence in Pakistan following the withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Recently, the Bangladeshi government made some seemingly bureaucratic modifications about Israel. It created such an outrage, or at least bafflement, that prompted the country's foreign ministry to reiterate that there is no change in travel policy towards Tel Aviv. However, given the recent developments inside the occupied territories, it might have been a test run to pilot the idea of formal diplomatic ties and see the feedback, because the wobbly new Israeli administration is in desperate need of a win.
A recent move by the Bangladeshi government to remove a clause from its electronic passports that barred its nationals from travelling to the Israeli-occupied territories has created uproar about the prospects of normalising ties with the regime. Although Dhaka says nothing has changed in its stance or foreign policy about the Israeli regime, the controversial decision shocked the Muslim nation, especially because lately Israel is under global condemnation for its recent war against the Palestinian people. Speculations over opening diplomatic ties with Israel have not been uncommon following a US-sponsored deal for Arab-Israeli normalization. Since the agreement, Washington and its allies have stepped up their efforts to force more and more countries to establish relations with the Israeli regime. The UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan have already established diplomatic and economic relations, while reports suggest that some other Persian Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, and even Pakistan may be also weighing their options regarding formal ties.
Removing the Accept Israel clause from the e-passports came as a shocking betrayal to the nation, but was greatly welcomed by the Israeli regime, which used the opportunity to call for formal relations with the Muslim country. Bangladesh says its position has not changed, and Dhaka would never recognize Israel until Palestine is established as an independent and sovereign country free of any occupation forces. So why did they move to facilitate relations? Why did they do it without telling people? And was the government hiding its ties from the nation?
Since Bangladesh's independence from Pakistan in 1971, the Muslim country has only recognized Palestine as a state, and the older Bangladeshi passports used to bear the sentence, "This passport is valid for all the countries of the world except Israel." In January last year, Bangladesh was among the first in South Asia and the 119th in the world to introduce the e-passport, a travel document with a small integrated circuit or chip embedded in the cover or pages. 6 months ago, when the South Asian country rolled out its new e-passport, the phrase was removed without any public announcement, and the information came to light only when Israeli officials started hailing Dhaka's move to lift the travel ban on Israel. Bangladesh's Home Minister Asaduzzaman Khan Kamal soon after acknowledged the change, saying that his government removed the words to ensure that the passports meet international standards. Foreign Minister A.K. Abdul Momin said, "The passport is just an identity and it doesn't reflect the foreign policy of a country." He said although Tel Aviv approached Dhaka for recognition and building bilateral ties on several occasions, Bangladesh's policy is still that of the father of the nation. Bangabandhu Sheikh Mujib, Bangladesh never recognizes Israel as long as Palestine is not established as a sovereign state free on any occupation army.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Dr. Sadr Abu Maryam, Secretary General of Palestine Foundation of Pakistan. Welcome to the program, sir. And recently, Bangladesh has dropped the accept Israel phrase from its passports, but the country's foreign ministry says there is no change in policy towards Tel Aviv. What's your take on this?
Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk with you regarding the issue of Bangladesh and Israel normalization. First of all, I would like to say that Bangladesh is a South Asian country. A majority have Muslim people, Muslim majority country, fourth Muslim majority country in the Islamic and Muslim world. In 1971, they have the Bangladesh has openly affirmed its position on pro-Palestinian cause. But still, their government, all of the successor governments of the Mujibur Rahman, they are following the same rules, same policy, which they adopted in 1971. Founding leader of Bangladesh, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, had taken a strong pro-Palestine stance, which was followed by all the successors till now. Sheikh Hasina led government, but such a sudden decision that came at time when Bangladesh is marking its golden jubilee, the 50 years of their country celebrations. This is a bad news. This is a very bad news for pro-Palestinian factor inside the Bangladesh. Especially they announced that the country passport will no longer bear the text except Israel for the new passport printing. It is very bad news for pro-Palestinian factor inside the Bangladesh, because you know that our Bangladeshi people, especially Muslims, they have their faith, they have their religious, they have their humanitarian, and all of the aspects. They have relation with the oppressed people of Palestine, and especially they have some sentiments, religious sentiments regarding the Holy Al-Aqsa and Quds al-Sharif.
Now, what happens if Bangladesh starts formal diplomatic ties with the Israeli regime, and what would be the reaction of about 150 million Bangladeshi Muslims?
Yes. As I told you earlier in the question, that the Bangladesh is the fourth Muslim populated country. You are also saying that 150 million Muslims. Yes, I think that the Muslims of Bangladesh will not accept these kinds of developments and the decisions. And it will not be accepted by the Bangladeshi Muslims. They will resist against the government, and I think they must resist to against these kinds of decisions. As I have many friends in Bangladesh, and last night and today, I also spoke with them and discussed with them the same issue. And I tried to get their consent regarding the same subject, and I found that people of Bangladesh will never remain keep silent if the Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina-led government would be normalized with Israel. I think if Bangladesh will normalize with Israel, so maybe political instability begin inside the country. As we know that the people of Bangladesh have their religious faith, have the humanitarian faith, and many other aspects and relations with the land of messengers, Palestine, especially with the oppressed people of Palestine. And what is happening in Palestine, they are witnessing, they are observing everything. And we saw that in last 11 days war, recently war of 11 days between Palestinian resistance and Zionist regime. The Bangladeshi people, the Muslims, they have supported Palestinian cause. They chanted the slogan in the streets. So I believe that Bangladesh, Muslims of Bangladesh, people of Bangladesh will never accept these kinds of decision, and they will must resist.
Could you tell us how can the West pressure Bangladesh into opening relations with Israel?
Yes, this is an interesting question. We know very well that the Western regimes, Western countries, and Western government, especially the U.S. and European governments, they always giving the opportunity to the monarchs, to the rulers of the Muslim and third world countries. They give them opportunities for how? They maybe United States and Western countries and Western government maybe give any opportunity to Bangladesh to trade with some European countries, some other, and maybe they can enhance this kind of trade which is already exists. And maybe United States guarantee to Sheikh Hasina that she will be more prime minister for next tenure. So these kind of things, I think they will pursue it with Bangladesh by offering economic packages and other such things than just the Bangladesh politics and intelligence agencies are already at the mercy of India. They are linked with Indian government, and India is a major enemy for Pakistan. So to can Western country through India put the pressure on Bangladesh, because Bangladesh has a good relations with India, and India is in the ties of United States and Israel at the same time. So I, in my opinion, the West maybe use Indian government as a tool to pressurize and to make the possible for Bangladesh to normalize with Zionist regime of Israel. The role of the Western world and India is also seen as an integral part of the process of changing worlds from Bangladeshi passport.
Now, do you think Bangladesh is going to normalize relations with Israel?
Yes, I think they are ready to normalize with Israel, but the people's stance is different. The government, the changing of the words from the passport of Bangladesh, it is the big and strongest proof that the government of Bangladesh is going slowly with normalization to Israel. But their hurdle is that the ideological boundaries would not allow them to do it. If they will do it, they will see the public awakening.
Thank you, Dr. Abu Mayyam, for your precious time. Now let's see how the people on social media see the situation.
Kiryu Ibn Kazuma has reiterated the official stance by the Bangladeshi government, but believes it can be the very first step toward Israeli normalization. Dr. Sanar Khan says dropping the phrase practically means lifting travel bans to the occupied territories, which means ignoring the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians. Ali Masum has underlined the timing of the decision by Dhaka, noting that it is a step towards accepting the Israeli regime. This account has called the Bangladeshi government traitors because of their betrayal to the Palestinian people and cause.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
The United States is set to remove its military forces from Afghanistan, and the deadline is September 11th. So Washington is trying hard to find a safe foothold in the region and what seems more feasible than the nearby friend Pakistan. However, the Pakistani government has said it wouldn't allow the U.S. to establish military bases across the border in Pakistan after the troops withdrawal.
According to an agreement signed between the United States and Taliban in Qatar's Doha, Washington should withdraw all American and NATO troops from Afghanistan. But to provide security for the U.S. interests and gather intelligence in Afghanistan, the U.S. needs to remain its forces close by. Pakistan seems a very plausible option, but there are many obstacles in the road. The Pakistani government is against any such ideas, and on the other hand, the hypothetical military bases would be so close to Afghanistan that Taliban would not accept it as leaving the country. Although many believe that Islamabad is unlikely to sign off on any U.S. strikes against the Taliban that are launched from a base in Pakistan, some believe Pakistan wants to allow U.S. access to a base if it can control how it is used.
The public opinion in Pakistan has been strongly against any renewed presence by the United States, and the government says it won't allow it. But there are many reported similar cases that the U.S. used bases in Pakistan and the government denied it. There is a sad joke that says the most common species of bird in Pakistan's sky is an American drone. And let's not forget that the U.S.-Taliban agreement happened because of Pakistan, without whose active support, Taliban leaders may have never even reached the negotiating table. Therefore, the initial rejection of U.S. bases may be part of Pakistan's bargaining strategy for more gains.
Pakistan has a history of covertly giving military bases to the U.S. Giving the U.S. a military base in the southwestern Balochistan province will have far-reaching political, diplomatic, and security implications for Pakistan and the entire region. In the 1960s, Pakistan denied giving the Peshawar Bedarbar Air Base to the U.S. until Russia shot down a surveillance plane that took off from it. The government also denied access to the Shamsi Air Base until a U.S.-led clash killed 24 Pakistani soldiers in 2011, when Pakistan expelled U.S. forces. Agreeing can cause severe backlash from the people, who are highly antagonistic towards the American war in Afghanistan, but refusing may mean getting further from U.S. and further isolation. Such a move by Islamabad can lead to more pressure through multilateral institutions such as the International Monetary Fund and the Financial Action Task Force. Moreover, the U.S. may be able to use it to shift the blame of its failures in Afghanistan on Pakistan, which was among the most significant factors behind the U.S.-Taliban Accord.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Sabina Siddiqui, foreign affairs journalist. Now, Mr. Siddiqui, the Pakistani government has said it wouldn't allow the U.S. to establish military bases across the border in Pakistan after the troops withdraw. Do you think Islamabad can resist such a demand if Washington insists on it?
It's like become a national security issue now, and the Taliban have threatened that any country that gives bases to the U.S. is going to be attacked by them and will be considered an enemy country as well. So consequently, Pakistan has categorically refused to give bases, and there's no more room left for that. No compromise is possible, as it is a national security matter for Pakistan itself now. However, Pakistan is actively engaged in the Afghan peace process, and negotiations are continuing. and Islamabad is trying its best to establish a successful peace process.
What happens if Imran Khan changes his decision and allows Washington to use Pakistan as a backup base when the American forces leave Afghanistan?
Well, the official statement has already been released. There's really no room left to change the PM to change his mind, as the Taliban are openly threatening us, and not only us, I guess they are. It's an open threat for anybody, any country, any neighboring country which gives them a base. So there are very few choices left. Plus, you see, Pakistan is also trying to mediate in a way between the Afghan government and the Taliban, and the process is continuing right now. Let's hope for the best. Maybe we have a positive outcome from that.
Now, will Taliban agree to continuous deals with the U.S. in case Washington manages to set up military bases in Pakistan?
Well, now, it depends more on how Washington deals with the matter, and I think they are doing their best. And I don't think civil war in the country suits the Taliban's interests or the Afghan government or even the U.S. So let's hope that better sense prevails and no such thing happens. Otherwise, that would be total chaos in the region.
Taliban has recently announced that Turkish forces must withdraw their troops as part of the deal with the U.S. for pullout of foreign forces. What does this say about the future of the country?
Well, it's I have been reading tweets a lot on Twitter from both sides. The Turkish side seems quite hopeful, quite optimistic that they will be able to hold on after the U.S. forces leave, as they are saying that they have never been attacked by the Afghans before. And there are Afghan accounts on Twitter threatening the Turks directly, but one doesn't know if they are genuine IDs or whatever. So it's a very fluid situation. It's very unpredictable. Maybe they can pull it off. Let's hope the Afghan peace process is completed satisfactorily before the U.S. forces leave. And the situation should be calm and there would be no such problem, I think. Then the mood will be better. And the Turkey seems to want a role. Maybe Istanbul is communicating with the Afghans behind the scenes. I don't think that can be ruled out either.
Now, will Islamabad eventually let the United States set up bases in Pakistani territory after their pullout from Afghanistan? And what does it mean for the U.S.-Pakistan relations?
Well, we have already refused. And as for the U.S.-Pak relations, our bilateral relations are there since decades, and it's not just about Afghanistan. We have viable ties in many other sectors and areas such as trade, and then there is, if Pakistan has a certain geostrategic value, and I don't think Washington would ignore, but the ties will continue satisfactorily. There may be, it's already happened, we have refused, so that is done. And the ties are still intact, so I guess we have survived.
Thank you, Mrs. Siddiqui, for being on the program. Now let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Asaf Bai has reflected the sentiments of the Pakistani people about the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Ahmed has criticized the use of assassinations drones from the Pakistani territory, asking the government to cooperate with other countries towards peace and not more wars. Abdullah Khan is of the opinion that allowing US bases may have constructive consequences for Pakistan if the country can have some sort of control over its activities. Ali Awan is a firm believer that Islamabad will not eventually bow to U.S. pressure and host military bases in its territories.
And that was our episode on the speculations over the future of relations between Bangladesh and Israel, as well as the US efforts to get Islamabad's go-ahead for military bases in Pakistan following the pullout from Afghanistan. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Coronavirus outbreaks renew questions about stuttering vaccine rollout and limited quarantine facilities, says Nino Bushi, reporter, in an article published under the heading Parts of Australia Under New COVID Lockdown After Cases of Delta Variant. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Australia is grappling with several outbreaks of the highly contagious Delta variant of coronavirus, with a wave of restrictions rolling across the country and plunging some cities into lockdown for the first time since the pandemic began. Residents of every state and territory in the country, except the island state of Tasmania, are again living under restrictions ranging from full-blown lockdowns in Sydney, Darwin, and Perth, to mask mandates in some indoor settings in Adelaide and Canberra. This regime is coupled with extraordinary restrictions on its citizens returning to or even leaving the country. The outbreak has renewed questions about Australia's stuttering vaccination program and limited quarantine facilities, both of which are responsibilities of the federal government. Australia has one of the lowest vaccination rates of any developed country, with less than 5% of the population fully vaccinated, and it has only one dedicated quarantine facility using hotels for other returned citizens. Recently, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, met state and territory leaders and agreed on a raft of new measures to keep up with the spread of the Delta strain, including even more stringent quarantine rules, as well as a no-fault indemnity scheme for all local doctors administering COVID vaccines. The scheme, in effect, opens the door for Australians under 40 to now receive the vaccine if they request it. Australians under 40 have so far been shut out from the COVID vaccine rollout as a result of concerns over blood clotting and a shortage of vaccines, besides locally produced AstraZeneca jabs in which the government has invested heavily. Every returned traveler leaving the strict quarantine system will be required to take a COVID test 2 to 3 days after leaving quarantine, as will their close contacts in those days. After the crisis meeting with state leaders, Morrison dug in behind Australia's strategy of suppressing COVID, insisting he was not prepared to countenance any reopening of Australia or relaxation of rules that would lead to death rates similar to those in other countries. It would be, I think, unwise to surrender up that advantage at this point, and preferably at no point, Morrison said. The center of Australia's outbreak is the Sydney suburb of Bondi, which has been linked to more than 120 cases, including some detected as far away as Perth, almost 2,000 miles away. And that is not the only case of transmissions from one city leading to outbreaks in another. Cases from Queensland have been linked to the first cases of community transmission recorded in Darwin. The Northern Territory Chief Minister, Michael Gunner, described the Delta variant as a tricky bugger as he decided to extend Darwin's first lockdown for a further 3 days to deal with an outbreak of two cases. The reality is we are not out of the woods yet, not by a long way, he said. The territory's fierce response to its first community cases is in part due to the vulnerability of its indigenous population, amid fears of lower vaccination rates and poorer general health within the Aboriginal community. In South Australia and the Australian Capital Territory, restrictions were introduced despite neither jurisdiction having recorded a case. In the latter, measures also had to be announced to limit panic buying of household items such as toilet paper. As has been common throughout the pandemic in Australia, the latest outbreak has featured prominent opposition to the sledgehammer approach of crushing the virus, including this time from the Deputy Prime Minister, and the emergence of strange anecdotes about people evading restrictions. Recently, three people from Sydney left the lockdown state on a private plane, unsuccessfully tried to land in Northern Territory and touched down in the outback opal mining town of Cooper Petty, where they were arrested.
It's بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The day of the elections is the day of the Iranian nation, June 18th, 2021. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and may peace and greetings be upon Prophet Muhammad and upon his pure household. The day of the election is the day of Iranian nation. The people are the ones who are controlling what is happening today. It is the people who determine the general and basic course of action in the country for years to come by going to the ballot boxes and casting their votes. This day belongs to the people. Whatever the people do on this day, going to the ballot boxes and casting their votes, will shape their destiny for several years to come. This is exactly why wisdom and reason tell us that everyone should take part in this great national test throughout the country. The reason we repeatedly ask people to participate in the elections is that this participation primarily influences the people. On the other hand, the country and the Islamic Republic of Iran will gain great advantages in the international arena due to the people's participation. But it is the people who primarily benefit from this. Come to the ballot boxes, discern which candidate is best, and cast your vote. This is what is important for the country's future and the future of every single person. Everyone's vote is important. No one should say that their one vote is not effective. Everyone's vote is definitely important. I believe that you should participate with a pure divine intention. It is these single votes that make up the millions of votes of the nation. I believe you should come to the elections with a divine intent, gain divine reward, and do this. I advise you to do this important, necessary action as soon as possible. I always say this. Yes, there are many hours left until the allotted time finishes. But the sooner you do this divine duty and action, the better. I hope God the Almighty gives blessings to your votes by His grace. God willing, you can form a promising future for yourself and every single person in the nation. We hope with the blessing of Imam Rida, peace be upon him, and these days are his days, this will be a day of celebration for the Iranian nation. And this will happen. With God's help, the nation will benefit, God willing. I thank those responsible for conducting the elections. I emphasize that this task be carried out determinedly in all areas of the country. I also say hello to you honorable journalists and photographers. May God give you strength. May God's peace, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Embargo, directed by Jerry Rice. And joining me in the studio, we have Tim Roby, who is a film critic for the Daily Telegraph, and who's also a regular guest on BBC Film 2017 and Radio 4's film programme. And beside him, we are also joined by Cuba expert Dr. Helen Yaffe, who is a lecturer at the University of Glasgow and has also written a book about Che Guevara's economic policies. Now, Embargo chronicles the story of the politics and collusion behind the Cuban embargo, its history, impact, and evolution, along with information from recently declassified documents and high-profile interviews. This film gives a unique perspective dating back before the 1959 Cuban Revolution that put Fidel Castro to power and led to the failed CIA-backed Bay of Pigs invasion and 1962's Cuban Missile Crisis. The film's compelling truths ultimately link the threads of an untold history and become the film's core message to end the embargo and looks to a future of rebuilding diplomatic and economic relations.
My father spent most of the 13 days in the White House, and he said that we had to be good soldiers and show up at school, that if there was a nuclear war, that none of us would want to be around afterwards.
Each small mistake would bring us to the confrontation. My father repeated, if we lose control, we will not be in charge.
Dad virtually told me nothing about Cuba. When Castro came in to overthrow Batista, my father must have been pretty thrilled, actually. You know, because you could remember Batista was not such a great guy.
We've been lied to since 1959 about Cuba, and we're still being lied to today. This unholy alliance between Nixon, the mafia, and the CIA still impacting us today.
At no time has the CIA engaged in any political activity that was not approved at the highest level.
We made it United States policy to assassinate Fidel Castro.
Wow, this is not what we bargained for. We just thought we were going to get rid of a corrupt government.
President held out an olive leaf to Castro, and he said to him, the United States history in Cuba has been a history of atrocities, And we understand that we're going to have to pay for that in one way or another.
Now, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this is a film that takes a critical look at the U.S.'s trade ban on Cuba and the political turmoil between the two countries. And it also features lots of generous footage of archive footage and high-profile interviews with historical figures and celebrities alike. And Tim, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, the subject is fascinating and has been thorny and, you know, much contested for, 60 years now. My feeling is that the subject deserves a more incisive treatment than this film, and one which is more analytical and more focused on what it's trying to achieve. For me, it feels like a kind of fairly skimpy overview. It's like a kind of whistle-stop tour of Cuba's sort of greatest hits historically since the 50s, which sort of lets you sort of land on the big moments, but doesn't really explain them. I mean, there are little nuggets of interest along the way, and some of the interviews do reveal things, but I felt that in general there was quite a lack of kind of intelligence around the film.
This surely is a huge subject with lots of layers, and perhaps for audiences who are not familiar with this issue, it serves as a good introduction to the subject. Helen, if I could turn to you, as someone who spent many years in Cuba and studied Cuba, what was your take on this documentary?
I think precisely for the reasons that you're saying, it's a good, engaging documentary. It has that historical overview, which I guess that, you know, when you've studied Cuba, you know that history, you sort of take it for granted that others do. But it provides that. There's some great archival image. There's really good interviews. My only issue with it is that because it was called Embargo, I was hoping to see more focus on the embargo and, you know, the series of laws that were introduced at different points by different presidents in the United States and the impact that they've had on the Cuban people and on the rest of the world because of the extraterritorial nature of the embargo. But as a sort of general introduction, it didn't offer anything particularly new or novel, but it was, you know, some nice material and a good reminder of, you know, that relationship between the United States and Cuba. I do think that there were areas where more analysis would have been useful. Why was the United States so hostile against the Cuban Revolution? What was it that they were doing that was so unacceptable to the US power structure? So more on...
That's precisely the questions, actually, I'd like to ask you a bit later on.
The major premise of the American blockade of Cuba is to starve the Cuban people into submission or rebellion. It is a violation of all moral and legal standards to use the starvation of people as a foreign policy tool.
Well, the embargo was originally intended to wreak havoc in Cuba and create instability. There's no two ways around that. In 1965, Johnson then added food